And it's time for Food Talk. I'm Marianne Myers, and I am here with the ever fabulous Linda Perkins. Good morning.
Good morning. I got my flannel apron on.
Really? I know.
I know. It's March at the coast. And I didn't even check the thermometer when I got up, but after the sun had been up for quite a while, it was 23.
Well, you live in a cold corner. Of the county.
Well, how much colder can it be than the rest of the county? It's not like we've got refrigerators. Well, we do.
It was 29 at my house.
Oh, really?
That's what I'm saying. We had the bonus 6 degrees. Anyway, you're right. It is cold, but it's
frosty.
Sunny.
Yeah, yeah. And then there wasn't any frost in my car. We don't get that kind of dry cold here, you know. I mean, I'm from Minnesota. I got family back there, and I'm sure they're laughing at me saying that 23 is cold, because if they were here, they'd be out in their Bermuda shorts in the lawn chair drinking gin and tonics, because I think the limiting thing to them going outside and drinking is that, you know, alcohol doesn't freeze yet, which I don't even know what that temperature is. It's so cold.
Oh my gosh. Holy cow. Well, what's happening food-wise in your world?
What's happening food-wise is that vanilla prices are dropping.
I know.
It's so exciting.
So what do you attribute that to? Because we have been fed this line that there has been a blight or a die-off of the pollinators, or there's been a million excuses for why vanilla got so expensive. But suddenly now it's not. Why, I wonder?
Well, it's not that it's not expensive. I mean, it's still many multiples of what it was 3 years ago. And I mean, it just dropped by like maybe the price of a pack of cigarettes. It's not like...
Well, that's a lot of money.
It is. That's why I use that. We can't say prices on public radio. And so I always use like pack of cigarettes as like a reference thing, because I'm always so appalled when I go to the grocery store and I see what a pack of cigarettes is. Yeah. Oh, and thankful too. But I don't know. But they're falling. It's not like they're in free fall or anything like that, but they're getting, the prices of vanilla are getting lower. And so I can only imagine that it's that they've been so high for like 3 years now.
Yeah.
That one of the factors that made them shoot up was that there were a couple of big storms, big hurricanes right in a row that killed crops. And they knew that they killed them 4 years before that, because that's when the bean sets. I don't know.
Oh,
you know
okay.
what I mean?
Right, right,
so
right.
So they knew that the bad crop was coming. And then there was a storm the year after that, too, minus 4 years. And so they knew that. So maybe that part is recovered a little. There's the whole supply and demand thing, and I'm not even going to pretend to know. But because, like you said, there's so many factors, but it's great. I still have 3 gallons left, and that's a real number.
Oh, my gosh.
From when it was like passing the $10 a pint
You're
price.
Probably affecting the market
no,
personally.
No.
It's like there's not as much vanilla being sold as there used to be. So,
but I'm a baker, and I mean, the price of vanilla directly affects my mental health.
I know. And you know, you just cannot substitute something
nope.
for it across the board.
No problem.
You can't
occasionally. I hate imitation vanilla.
Oh, no, you can't even use that.
No,
but I mean, you can't just decide, okay, I'm going to use almond extract.
Yeah.
It, sometimes you can.
Sure, but it makes it a different thing.
Yes,
you know?
Yes.
It's a different product that you're making.
Yep.
Yep. Vanilla price is going down, roller coaster going up.
We're so excited. So that's the good news. Are you said just before we went on air, you said you had some baking to do.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to, let's see, what am I making? Come on, brain. A lot of cookies.
Yeah.
And, muffins, you know, stuff like that. You do
yeah.
too, though.
Yeah,
you
do.
The baking for the
staff
volunteers here.
Yeah, during Pledge Drive, which is coming up, by the way. So
just a couple days, huh?
I know. That is the big... fun thing that happens a couple times a year around here and makes for interesting and out of the ordinary radio, which I love about Pledge Drive,
yeah.
is that you get to hear voices you don't normally hear and all of that good stuff. But yes, I am going to do today and tomorrow a massive bake of things just for the mornings around here, so that
just for the volunteers to have something to snack on,
because yeah.
they're here a long time, especially
yes.
you know, the people manning the phones. And it's interesting here because a lot of the staff here are gluten free.
Yes.
And so I know you get to do some really interesting baking.
I do everything gluten free.
Yeah.
Because
so they can
I have not
it all.
Yet, although I, you know, I'm waiting. I have not yet heard anybody say that they're allergic to gluten free. So So I'm just like, I'm playing it safe. And also, I got to say, although we don't trumpet specific brands of anything on the radio, or try not to act like we're promoting anybody in particular, there is one product that's called One-to-One gluten-free flour that I think is better than any other product for those of us who normally would not bake gluten-free, because you don't have to do any calculations. You get the loft and the texture, which often are the things that I object to about gluten-free pastries, is that
the puck-like quality.
Yeah. So I'm really grateful for that, and it makes it really easy to do. So I'm getting ready after this. I'm going to go over to the food web and start sifting.
Well, when I bake, you know, if I use that reminds me of something. If I use buttermilk, I like to make my own buttermilk. You guys know that. But it's because it's so much thicker, and I just like how baked goods turned out better than with just kind of that milk-like, milk consistency, liquid buttermilk that you get commercially. So this is kind of halfway between yogurt and milk, and I like that. And there's this thing I've been reading about called homesteading, and just reading a little on the internet, but it's something that I knew, but it's a word I'd never heard, you know, put on it. And what it means is it's like, if it kind of like a vertical operation, if you make your own buttermilk and then you make your own muffins and, you know, like you manufacture like yourself every step of the process. Does that make sense? And there's things I do that with like buttermilk, but you know, I have also more than once in my life cut open a pack of ramen, taken out the flavor pack, and boiled it up and put some frozen wontons in it and a handful of spinach and said, dinner. And so I have also, maybe that's anti-homesteading, but I was wondering, like what, do you have things that you do that where you start at not the ridiculous, do you know what I mean? Like not grinding your own wheat, but do you have things where you do more steps than people normally would?
I always make my own yogurt.
Okay, yeah, that's right.
And and for a couple of reasons, we go through a lot of yogurt because every breakfast I fix for my husband includes a smoothie. And I really just like certain consistency of yogurt.
Yeah.
So I like that Bulgarian culture yogurt.
Yes, and that's the best buttermilk too.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay.
So good.
Yeah. And I have made creme fraiche before, which I like very much. Homemade, but I don't use a lot of it, so I tend to make it when I need it.
Yeah, but it's so expensive in the store, and all you do is you just put cream on the counter with this starter with this culture about 36 hours, and then you've got creme fraiche, and it's really good.
And the consistency is really great. And the thing about commercially available creme fraiche is that it's nerfy almost. Do you know what
kind
I mean?
Kind of gloppy.
Yeah, it's more gelatin-like.
More panna cotta-y.
It's the difference between Greek yogurt and not Greek yogurt, you know, in that it doesn't have much creaminess to it. It can be really delicious.
Yeah.
And you like can whip it into submission.
It feels like there's emulsifiers in there that aren't in the stuff that you make.
And I don't know that that's true, but I just like the consistency. Same with yogurt, same with buttermilk. I like the consistency of the homemade better.
Seems like it's, you know, creme fraiche plus xanthan gum or something like that. I don't know what it is, but ever so slightly, not ridiculously.
What is a xanthan? I'm always
they have beautiful flowers. I made that up.
I have no idea what and it starts with X too, so there's so much mystery about xanthan. Anyway, it's in a lot of things,
and it's a lot of points in Scrabble.
It's huge in Scrabble.
but also like there's people, you know, like my CSA farmers markets, you know, the egg day at the food web, where I can buy things that feel like I've homesteaded. I have these pickles that were homemade, you know, that kind of thing. And I can put them on a sandwich and it makes the sandwich way better. But I didn't do all those steps before the pickles, but it's still not a commercial product.
Yes.
I don't know. I think it's interesting to think what is worth it to make yourself in your life, you know?
Yes. And I also think that there's so many, I mean, to me, the obvious benefit is, and the incentive often, is the flavor.
Yeah.
You know, so that's the thing that makes you look for that. And then you realize that you're contributing to a local economy, mm-hmm. An agricultural economy that can absolutely use some help. Mm-hmm. We just don't have that agricultural economy going on in this corner of the Oregon coast like we used to in the old days. We've used the land for other things now. So anytime I can have something delicious and know that the person who created that or grew it or mm-hmm. raised it or foraged it is getting the money. Mm-hmm. I love that. Mm-hmm. That's just the big bonus. So, and also I think it's really healthy to have, to eat food that is fresh and grown with care and intention and for those preserves and pickles that we've been loving so much are just not the run of the mill jam you would normally have.
Yeah.
Kind of like your garage full of jars of jam. Kind of like your freezer full of blackberries.
But it's one thing. I mean, I do really like making jam, and I guess that's something that I homestead. But it's because I love black caps so much, and they're such a hyper-local berry, and it's just not something that you can really go out and buy. Occasionally, you'll see it someplace, but I really like it. And so, you know, I'll make blackberry jam with black caps in it. I'll make black cap jam, but it's something that, like you said, I like the buttermilk I can make better. I like the creme fraiche I can make better. I like the jam I can make better. And then maybe that's it. Maybe like Jennifer Bright, her pickles are great. You know, I can't make those. I don't have that recipe. So I will buy those, but it still, it just feels more like it's homemade than buying something from the store. You know what I mean?
Yep. I totally do. Really so much more delicious. I'm trying to come up with things to bake that I normally don't bake because I don't want to, for 10 days in a row, give the poor staff around here a different flavor scone for 10 days in a row. So
What about that bakery, Grand Central Baking in Portland, they do those jammers, you know, where it's just essentially a scone or a biscuit, and then they hollow out the center and they put a bunch of jam in there, and that gets rid of old jam too. Do you need any?
Seriously, I have so much jam from you and from Jennifer and from other places because I don't make jam. That I either have to find a use for jam, so that might be one, or I have to get a support for the pantry shelf. One of the two. Anyway, I'm going to try a few things that, you know, if you bake a lot, you can read a recipe and decide basically if you think that flavor profile or that mm-hmm. Whatever it is.
If it's going to be good to you.
Yeah, if it's going to be good to you. Or you could read it and say, oh, if I just added a little lemon zest to that, I would love that, I think.
Or so, Daddy bought this girl a blog.
Well, isn't that the case?
Oh, so often.
I know. So I'm going to, and baked oatmeal is one of the things that I traditionally do for any kind of a breakfast thing that you're not going to have hot food for. Mm-hmm. Baked oatmeal is a really good delivery system. It's like, cut it like brownies.
I made one recently with just a bucket of apples in it, and it was really good.
I'm going to use apples. I usually use blueberries, but I happen to have a lot of apples, so I'm going to do that. And also some breakfasty kind of custard things, I found a really delicious sounding recipe for pears and figs, and it's not fig season, but I'm gonna reconstitute some dried figs overnight and probably in booze, and then do a baked thing that you can cut into squares.
Oh, this is Cameron. Would you like to donate?
It's baked booze. I don't think we're getting
much less fun.
We're going to love it, but not for that reason. I need to remind everybody that they're listening to Food Talk on Coast Community Radio, KMUN 91.9 FM Astoria, and KTCB in Tillamook. So we're not just living on baked goods.
No. Well, I had recently been talking to my friend Jerry, and I mentioned this before. She says that beef doesn't freeze well, and it occurred to me, yeah, you know, I thought, and it, a lot of times it will lose a bunch of liquid. And so I really started looking into it, and it turns out that if you believe my good friend the internet, that it's because I had some beef tenderloin and I didn't want to mess it up. So I was thawing it in the fridge really slowly, you know, doing the cold water circulating thing also. And none of it was really working. And so what it seems to be is that the problem is because I have, I should say a full sentence, shouldn't I?
That would be
not
so
gonna
nice.
Today. Nope. But I have like flat iron steaks.
Yes.
I really like flat iron steaks.
Yes.
And they freeze just perfect. And they're just not that different of a, they're both beef and they're just not that different of a muscle. So, but they're very different sized. One is half a pound and one is 3 pounds. And so, it sounds like from what the internet says that the problem is not how I thaw them, but how I freeze them.
And
they have to be frozen quickly. Beef has to be frozen quickly. The slower that it freezes, then the more cellular damage there is, and then the more leaky it is when you thaw it out. And so so you have to first put your beef in the fridge and get it as cold as it can be in the fridge. You know, put it in your coldest drawer in the fridge. And then I think what I'm going to do, and I'm sure what I did is, you know, put stuff together in the freezer. You have to put it separate from...
So that it gets circulated.
Right. And then you know how often things are in like foam trays, you know? Put them upside down so that the face down is on something already frozen, not protected by the foam tray. And so just whatever you can do to make it freeze as fast as it can possibly freeze will make it thaw better. And that totally makes sense for I've only had problems with big things, not little things.
Uh-huh. That's really interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
And something that we could actually do something about. I love that. Speaking of beef, I have a question for you.
You have a beef with me?
I'd love to because it's a big piece of meat. But I got talked into by a lovely rancher at Meet Your Farmer the other day. I got talked into buying London Broil, which I have not had for approximately a million years.
Yeah.
It's a very old-fashioned thing in my mind. It used to be like the ultimate thing to order in a fancy restaurant.
Really?
Yeah. But now I can't even remember. I don't even know that I've ever cooked a London broil.
Yeah, I don't think I have, and I don't know a thing about it.
It implies broiling.
Well, I always, you know, there's like those cross rib roasts and London broils and all that, and I always just go to the chuck because I like it so much, you know?
Yeah.
And it's cheap, and I don't know a thing about London broil.
Well, I guess what I'm going to have to do for food talk purposes is to cook it before our next show and then report in. Because I will do some research and figure out what sounds like the best way.
Oh, that would be so funny, though. So you could cook it for here. Like there's oatmeal one day, muffins the next, and there's custard, and then London broil. Like everybody, dig in.
I got to say that starting about a year ago, I've been doing food for Pledge Drive for a long time, but starting about a year ago, we went to Pledge Drive Light because I used to bring the warming tray or the...
I know, it'd be like lasagna. And
it was crazy.
And people were leaving here fat.
Well, I don't care about that. That's not my problem. It's just that I'm old and crotchety now, and I don't want to schlep all that stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
So it is more... And also, I realize that, yes, people are here for a long period of time working hard during Pledge Drive, but really 4 hours without a heavy meal, we're probably not going to suffer.
Yeah.
So
no,
it's
but it's
more
nice. You have sandwiches.
Yeah. It's light.
Crudité. But it would be funny if you showed up with a whole warming station and a London
in a white chef's coat. I think that would be good. I have to sharpen my knife.
Excuse me.
I have no idea what to do with this. I'm telling you, that's what happens when you're at a Meet Your Farmer event and some really cute rancher goes, have you ever tried London broil?
Bavette.
Yes, Bavette.
Oh, well, I cleaned my fridge out.
And?
Oh, it was pretty okay, but I have these Lucite plastic long skinny bins, you know?
Yeah.
I like them. So there's just... I think my fridge is pretty much just for holding condiments. You know, there's all the mustards and Chinese sauces and condiments and all the things. I call them the bins of perpetuity because they're the things that, you know, the stock pastes and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Stuff that stays forever in your fridge. But every once in a while, something will get in that bin of perpetuity that's not supposed to be in there. It's so nice just to be able to pull it out and look at everything. But then you're like, oh, blueberries from September. And that was the case. I found some blueberries from last year.
Did they have coats on or were they just dried? Because dried blueberries are very expensive.
No, they were solid. They were like, they'd joined forces.
In an attempt to survive.
Yes. Like a slime mold where it all comes together and forms single animal to move about to find someplace else to live.
I found one of those in my fridge recently.
A slime mold?
Yeah. A primordial life form, actually. I think we were just a lightning strike away from, you know, crawling out of the ooze. I don't know. Anyway, it was scary. And although I did wash the container that it was stored in, because I tend to use containers that other product came in and wash them and use them over and over again. And I'm like, the jury is out on whether or not that's ever going to get used again. Or
I know. I'm totally the same way. I just make the judgment call. Nope, the plastic's compromised.
I'm going to wash it and it's going straight into the recycle.
And there's also the, I don't want to open that. I am not going to open that. I'm not going to let that air into my kitchen. Whoop, throw it away.
Oh, I hadn't even thought about releasing the air.
Yeah, scary air.
Yeah, not to mention spores, because you never know.
It's so sick that I have 3 gallons of vanilla and I want to go out and buy more vanilla because it's getting cheaper.
Really, Linda?
No. I understand that that's not a normal urge, but it's there.
Oh, I see. I know.
I'm not going to act on it.
On behalf of everyone listening, I feel I must try to talk you down off that ledge.
Off the vanilla cloud.
You know, the other thing is it dooms you to bake forever because you have all that, you're obligated to use that vanilla and you're trying to cut back on the baking.
No, I know, but it's such a luxury to have that and know that it's there. I know that's a little ridiculous, but I love it. It's so good.
You could go on a ice cream binge.
Oh, that's true.
A big ice cream binge. There's almost nothing better, I think, than homemade ice cream.
Yeah.
I mean, if I were coming up with a dessert for a company, it would be hard for me to think of anything better than that.
Something that I love is vanilla ice cream and raspberry sherbet together. I just think that is so good.
That's like a raspberry creamsicle.
Yeah, it's just so good. And then that's really one of the main things that I use my sous vide for is, and that's at water bath that you hold things at a constant temperature, is for the custard for ice cream, you know, for making sure that the eggs are cooked because... food safety. I know the USDA publishes a list every year of the 10 most offensive food items, and often ice cream is on there because of the custard. People get sick from the eggs, you know.
Yeah.
And you wouldn't think people could get sick from ice cream, but it's because the eggs weren't
cooked long enough. Yeah.
And so I just know for sure I got them at the right temperature. I can hold them right at that temperature, so they're not going to turn to cheese or anything like that. But
I hadn't even thought about that for a sous vide. That's a really good.
Yeah.
That's a really good way. It's hard to get it just right, although if you make a lot of ice cream, you can get it just, you know, you get used to how that works with custard of any kind.
Yeah.
But I am also guilty of using raw eggs and things like Caesar dressing.
Yep. Egg yolk is a great emulsifier.
It's fabulous.
Yeah. I think I remember reading, because I don't know why I read so much on food safety, but here I am, Little Miss Food Safety Know-It-All.
Well, you're worried about killing your family.
Yeah.
And the rest of us hardly ever even think of that.
No. It would be so sad.
It would be terrible.
I think in America, the number last time I read it, which was at least 3 years ago, was that 1 in 10,000 eggs has salmonella in it. In America, for some reason, the salmonella has figured out how to get into the occasional egg. Otherwise, it's always on the outside. But that was like, 1 in 10,000. So your odds are pretty good that egg's okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel better about eggs when I have a passing acquaintance with the chicken or the person who takes care of the chicken. I'm never really sure about, I don't know. I suspect, and I do not know this for a fact, but you probably do. I have wondered because...
I'm going to pretend.
Usually the... Good. Often the cause of contamination in eggs comes from the shell.
The outside.
Yes.
Always. And that's just in America. That's the new thing, is that it has figured out how to get inside the egg, just 1 in 10,000 eggs, and it's factory farmed eggs.
Do you think that the factory farm eggs get treated like with a bleach solution or anything before they go packaged?
I don't know, but it wouldn't affect anything inside the egg. That's the thing.
No, I understand. Yeah. But
I think so, because don't they get washed? Aren't they required to be washed? No. That's the big difference between eggs in Europe and eggs in America.
Yes. And yes, they're always really spotlessly clean. But I wonder if they're sanitized in any way. But then I worry about that because
they're porous. The
shell must be, to some extent, porous for anything to be able to get through.
That's why you don't wash eggs in your dishwater, because then your eggs will taste soapy. Because it goes in. So, yeah, I don't know how they wash them in.
You couldn't. I don't think you could without affecting the... I think they must just wash them with water.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Hey, somebody was talking on the internet about steaming eggs. Like instead of boiling hard-boiled eggs, steaming them. And they said that if you steam them, if you put them in a steamer basket, which would be... I mean, if you're already... boiling something like pasta or something, that would be a way to like effectively use energy.
Yes.
Put them in a steaming basket above it. But they said that if you steam the eggs rather than boil them, that they peel a lot easier.
I wonder if that's true. I don't know, but I'm going to try that, because that is the problem with really great fresh eggs.
Yeah.
Is
they cling to their shells for dear life.
It's so annoying that peeling a bunch of hard-boiled fresh eggs for any occasion is cause for great profanity, strings of profanity.
I remember once, and this is a couple decades ago, I was making deviled eggs. Of course, that's what you make with hard-boiled eggs. It's the only thing you're allowed to make.
Ever.
Yeah. And peeling a dozen eggs. And it was that. They were just cemented on. It was taking forever. And I remember I was on the 11th egg, and they looked like they were peeled by Edward Scissors hands. I mean, they were just awful. And I was just, it had taken so long, and I was so frustrated. I'm like, I'm gonna take a break. I'm gonna go to the bathroom. I went to the bathroom, and I came back, and the cat had gotten up on the counter and batted all of them down to the dogs.
Oh, no.
All that work. Oh.
Oh my god. Oh, one time I was doing a giant event, and I got the case of 15 dozen eggs.
Yeah.
And boiled them all. And then my wonderful friend Gretchen Blissett, who is a fabulous chef.
Yeah.
And also an extremely wonderful friend. And this would be evidence of that, because she said, I'll peel them.
Oh.
Because I had a big long list of chores. And she goes, oh, I'll just take the eggs and peel them. Because they were going to be deviled eggs.
Okay.
And I remember getting a text or an email or something from her later saying, our thumbs are bleeding.
Because, I can't imagine.
You know, that's a lot of eggs. Oh. And yes, it hurts your thumbs.
Yeah.
Anyway, horrible. Oh. Yeah. I'm not interested in doing 15 dozen deviled eggs ever again.
Well, I've done this thing where you boil eggs in water and you put a little baking soda. And
really?
It's about half a teaspoon, I think.
Per?
Not a lot. Just in a little pot of water.
Yeah.
And then, so they are porous, and they end up tasting like baking soda. So it's not the most optimal thing, but the shells come off immediately. So you can do this thing where you, with your finger, you know, you take a little bit of the shell off one end and a little bit of shell off the other. And then, you blow in one end. Okay, so you've got a little hole in the shell that's about the size of your pinky nail on both ends. And then you blow, and the egg will come out the hole. And I've done that with my nieces and nephews, and, you know, it's like a great auntie thing to do. Auntie's magic with eggs. But
you got to keep that in the family. Like, I'm not going to do that to eggs that other people have to.
I think you blow in the little end, and then it comes out end. Yeah. But it makes a funny noise before it comes out, and then it just bloops, comes right out that hole. It's really funny to see.
Hard-boiled egg.
That's not really cooking, is it? I'm probably going to get a letter.
As so often is the case with this show.